Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the studios of KSFR, streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes, and you can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. And by the way, Robert Knott will not be with us today. I'm delighted now to welcome Lisa Jones. She's the author of the new book, Broken, A Love Story. And she will be speaking and signing books at the Teresa Neptune Gallery at 616 and a half A Canyon Road this Saturday, August 22nd, from 4 to 7. It's an event sponsored by Garcia Street Books. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hi.
This is a very intense and fascinating book, which started out as, well, it started out as a weekend in which you went up to the Wind River Indian Reservation to witness a man who was apparently very good at breaking horses in a gentle way. Tell us that story.
Well, it was actually a four-day clinic that he was holding, and he was Stanford lives on the Wind River Indian Reservation in Wyoming, and he was having a growing reputation for gentling horses in a really humane way, which was even made more extraordinary by the fact that he's a quadriplegic who works his craft from a wheelchair.
Now, just to clarify, Stanford Addison, not breaking horses, but gentling horses, but with the same basic effect?
Oh, yeah. I mean, well, actually, the effect is better because the horse's spirit stays intact, and so much of the kind of horse training that happens kind of really breaks the horse, you know, breaks their spirit. And, I mean, there's all kinds of new techniques coming out, like natural horsemanship and things like that are really great. But Stanford had developed his own technique, and he could have a rank beginner like me go into a corral with a horse that had never really been touched or trained and had spent, you know, pretty much all of its life on the open range on the reservation up there in Wyoming, and he could kind of choreograph it and tell the person what to do with the horse.
You were not only somebody who'd never broken horses before, but you actually had a fear of horses.
Oh, yeah. I did. I had a really mean pony when I was 9.
With the soul of Charles Manson, if I remember the book correctly.
Yeah, exactly. The soul of Charles Manson and the body build of, I can't remember what, I think a soccer ball.
Right.
A little fat, mean pony, you know, that are really awful sometimes. And this horse used to buck me off, and he liked to run under the low-hanging branches of a tree a lot, and I would end up in the tree quite a bit when I was 9. So I wasn't exactly comfortable with horses.
Meanwhile, you go up there for this four-day horse gentling workshop, and there's a quotation from the beginning that was really striking. You said that you saw the horse, I mean, these were wild horses. You saw the horse shedding wildness like a shoe he'd always wanted to take, a tight shoe that he'd always wanted to take off.
Yeah, yeah, it was really extraordinary. I was just watching when the clinic began, I was up there actually writing a magazine assignment for Smithsonian Magazine, and I said to Stan very early, you know, I am so not going to get in the corral with a horse because of, you know, my tragic background with my pony. And so I was watching a woman, the first woman in our clinic, was gentling a horse, and her name's Paula McCaslin, and she did an amazing, wonderful job. And that horse, it was like, it was definitely skittish and nervous, but it really wanted, what became apparent as I watched it was that it really wanted things to work out okay. And I had never seen that in a horse before. And Paula, within 2 or 3 hours, was sitting on the horse, and the horse had never been, you know, it had been branded, I think, is all. You know, she was, a 3-year-old mare who had pretty much been running wild. And I was so touched by that, and the mare had these beautiful eyes, really, you know, really beautiful, deep, peaceful, well, eventually peaceful eyes. And it was just such a beautiful thing to watch, you know, that, oh, my God, that horse really wants this. in a way. You know, that was a story I put on it anyway, and it was just really touching to me.
So then you were drawn to go back, and that led to a story that you probably never in your wildest dreams expected.
Yeah, to say the least. I was so blown away during my first visit, during the horse clinic, because after I see Paula work her horse, I thought, oh, I want to do that too. And I had quite a different experience than Paula had, but it was really magical what happened to me in there. And even just meeting Stanford for the first time, it was really quite... it's the kind of thing you see in a Hollywood movie or something, you know. He rolls up to me, and I'm shy, and I'm not really looking straight at him. And he comes up to me, he rolls up to me that morning, and just looks at me, and it was like a bolt of energy went through me, and I thought, oh man, your life is about to change. And I didn't even know what that meant, but it was like a body knowledge, like, you know, you're done, you're toast, your current way of operating is toast. And that was really thrilling and also really scary. And but it was very clear, you know, and it was nothing that came through my head. It was nothing he said. All he said was like, hello, or hi, or welcome to Wyoming, or something. And I was, you know, there I was kind of quaking in my boots. And
well, the way you describe him, one gets the sense that for just about anybody he encounters, he can see right through them, which on the one hand is disconcerting, but on the other hand, he has so much kindness that you don't feel, invaded.
Right. And it took me a while to parse that out, though, because I never had just come up against an energy like that that felt like, he really, there's no use, you know, lying to this guy. It was like my body knew that. So, yeah, but eventually, you know, he is a very safe person. And I really, it took me a while. You know, I had some really, I think, Hollywood-based fantasies about what a shaman could do to you, you know, or I don't want to use that word shaman. He doesn't use that word shaman to identify himself, and he doesn't use the word medicine man either. He calls himself a spiritual enthusiast. But here's a person who had he had some powers that I do not have and that no one else I know has either. And, but it takes a while to adjust to that and go, oh, he's not going to, you know, make me into his slave, or he's not going to mess with me. Even though he's got some powers that in our culture aren't developed or recognized at all.
How did you get the idea of writing his life story?
Well, it took a little while after that kind of magical first 4 days up there for me to realize what I wanted to do next with it, because I was in the middle of the reservation in Wyoming, and I've been on a lot of reservations doing a lot of stories, and usually as soon as I was as a journalist and as soon as I was done, I was like, I'm out of here. I feel uncomfortable here. I feel guilty here. I feel shy here, you know. And I found myself at the end of that 4 days with Stanford not wanting to leave, which was a really remarkable emotion for me to have at that time anyway. But I went home and I just went back to my regular work, which was, I was pretty much a magazine writer. I wrote about food and the environment mostly. And I realized I just want to go and sort of toddle around behind this guy. You know, I want to follow him around and be around him and see what happens. So I thought, oh, wow, I'm a writer. I could write his life story. So I called him. It took 9 months for me to make that phone call. And I called him, and he's like, sure, come on.
That's a nice gestation period.
Yeah, it's kind of funny. It's kind of an interesting metaphor.
So he was somebody, Stanford Addison, who during his youth was really not a very nice person, the way you describe it in the book. He used people. He was utterly selfish. And then he had a horrible car accident.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, he was kind of an outlaw. I mean, kind of a small-time outlaw who, you know, dealt drugs and shot cattle for fun and robbed a cafe and, you know, had tons of women and was charismatic, and he had hair down to his waist. You know, he was this really gorgeous, young, angry native guy. And then he had a car accident. And then, he went through an extraordinary transformation that took probably 12 years.
It's funny because he was given 12 years to live, and at the end of 12 years, instead of dying, he was really a full-on healer.
Yeah, he was really coming into it. And he, what happened is after he was paralyzed in this really terrible accident involving a truck and a horse, he not only had he lost his physical powers, which had been everything to him, you know, he was 20 years old, he was a bronc buster, he was a karate guy, he was in a band, you know, and not only was that all taken from him, but suddenly he was being visited by spirits who were giving him interesting abilities. And he didn't want those at all. He didn't want it. He thought that was a pretty lousy trade, and he tried to cash it all in and die. You know, he tried to commit suicide. He tried to get other people to kill him. He tried everything to get out of the deal. And then it didn't work ever. And to get out of the deal, he couldn't succeed at leaving this life. So he accepted it with the help of an important uncle of his, and I guess just with the passage of time, you know, he just realized this is it, and he became quite a powerful healer and an amazing horse trainer, gentler, who worked with horses much differently than he himself had as a young man, because he himself as a young man had learned the real cowboy way, the really quite brutal way.
The stories of that brutal cowboy way were really shocking to me. I don't know much about horses, but, I mean, people hitting horses on the head with 2x4s. And, you know, there was a moment where he came back and saw a whole bunch of people who'd been basically the victims of a horse uprising because the horses were being so brutally treated that they just turned against their supposed caretakers who were trying to break them, and he said, boy, there's got to be a better way.
Yeah, yeah. The 2x4 one wasn't really wasn't normal, even for that.
Right.
But that was one particular other guy who did that. But yeah, it was a pretty brutal way. You sacked them, and you confused them, and you blindfolded them, and then you just, you know, rode them out as they bucked. And there is one, I thought, kind of funny day when all the horses took their revenge on all their riders, and no one was killed, but some people were, pretty much everyone had to go to the hospital, I think. And, I mean, that's terrible to laugh about something like that, but it was like, whoa, how did this all happen on the same day? Five horses.
Right.
Four or five horses are having their say with these guys. But, so Stan was confined, you know, it was his worst nightmare as a young man to be confined and unable to move physically. But he's a very smart guy and perceptive, and he started watching what worked and what didn't work with working with horses. And he came up with a really, fairly simple and quite humane way of doing it. So it was after he developed that a little bit and he got a reputation that I heard about that's how we met, was on that.
We're talking to Lisa Jones, the author of the book Broken, A Love Story. It's such an interesting thing that when somebody, I mean, he'd had some little brushes with the so-called spirit world before that, but when somebody gets into a state of very great physical pain, illness, suffering, hospitalization. I've actually known other people who've had this. I knew one woman who was in a horrible car accident, And during the time that she was in the hospital, she was completely psychic. She could see auras. She could tell when she was being given the wrong medicine, even though she couldn't see the labels. And she found it incredibly disconcerting and wished for it to go away. And as soon as she got better, it did go away. This is a person, Stanford Allison, Addison, who had to really deal with it because it wasn't going away.
Right, right. And, you know, when you're a kid or a teenager, you think, oh, wouldn't that be so great if I could, you know, name that magic power or name that kind of power. But as an adult, it's a lot of responsibility. And he didn't want it. He didn't want it. He wasn't interested in that. And I think he was intimidated by the amount of responsibility that came with that kind of thing.
But he took it on, and his medium for healing others, and probably himself as well, was the sweat lodge.
Yeah. Now, this is why he doesn't consider himself a medicine man, because his healing powers are only available to him in the sweat lodge, and he considers himself, quote, middle management in the sweat lodge. He doesn't heal people, but healing happens through him. So, yeah.
What was that like? You started doing sweat lodges yourself.
Well, sweat lodges are, they're intense. They're not easy, but they're really, I love them. And it gets very dark, completely dark. It gets very hot. There's a lot of praying, and there's a lot of Arapaho spoken. And then, right when you think you're going to perish of heat, they open the doors and everyone lies around and tells jokes for half an hour. And then they do the next round. It's four rounds. There's four really hot periods, at least in Stanford's sweat lodge. I haven't been in very many other sweat lodges. I'm pretty sure that's pretty standard in a lot of them, though. But yeah, it's a very, Stanford has said to me before, he said, our spiritual practices are really difficult because that's how our lives are, you know, Arapaho life. And it really comes out of a cultural acceptance of suffering.
That's another theme in the book, is this cultural acceptance of suffering and really a teaching of endurance of suffering, but it's not a solitary stoicism. I mean, you contrast it to parts of white culture. There, the suffering is accepted, but it's shared, and so people aren't so lonely.
Yeah, it's actually really, it's a wonderful experience. I always just feel so so much better after a sweat lodge because, yeah, you've come through this pretty onerous thing to altogether, and you know, there's somewhere between, in Stanford sweat, there's between 10 and maybe 40 people in there, and there you are all together, and it's hot for everybody, you know, it's really, really hot, and then there's lots of prayer, and if you there's a belief that the more you pray, you know, if you lean into that suffering and don't just get on the ground where it's cold, where it's cooler, but stay upright and keep praying, that, you know, the Creator will hear your prayer better. And then right minutes after that, you're lying on the ground laughing about something with the kind of cool evening air, you know, soothing you. And it's a long ceremony. It usually lasts about, I don't know, 3 or 4 hours at Stanford's. And there is this real feeling of togetherness. And people talk very frankly about what's going on that's bothering them. And for me, and Stanford has these usually, he's been in having some health challenges lately, but usually there's two of those per week at his house. And if you're up there and you're doing two sweat lodges a week, it makes your life feel so much better and more kind of tied to other people's lives, because you know what's going on with them and you know how they are when they're sincerely sharing the contents of their lives and what's really hard for them, and then you know what they're like when they're laughing and joking, and then you get to eat together, and it felt like a really complete experience, because it had the whole spectrum of emotion is pretty much covered at night, you know, in that one ceremony, Whereas I feel like in my life, my white life, you know, I live in Boulder, Colorado, and in my white life, it's there isn't something I do twice a week that encompasses all that. You know, there's a kind of smiling and waving, and I'm okay, and you know, I'm white, everything's cool thing. And then there's very private, dark times that you share maybe with one intimate or a couple of intimates. But it felt really, you know, it felt like it's a recognized part of life that there's suffering and that it's okay to suffer together, and you don't have to hide your suffering from each other so much there. And that was like manna from heaven for me.
It's such an interesting contrast that you were living at that time, and part of it was also that you had studied Buddhism and you'd grown up in, what was it, Presbyterian?
Yeah, I grew up in Scotland as a child, and that's very Presbyterian. It's not exactly woo-woo, you know.
Right, and so between
it's pretty frosty. Yeah.
Exactly, and between Buddhism and Presbyterianism, and your boyfriend at the time, now husband, was deciding whether to be a Buddhist monk,
yeah,
or to stay with you, and meanwhile, so that cool spirituality was contrasted to this literally and metaphorically hot spirituality that you were encountering in Wyoming in these sweat lodges.
Right, right. And I like the heat. Who knew, you know? You never know in life what's going to work until you run into it. And I was like, oh, my God, I love this. This feels like, you know, alchemy, and it feels like things moving together in a really good way.
Meanwhile, you were writing this supposed life story about him as a journalist, but the book ended up being so participatory on your part, and it's as much a story about you as it is about Stanford Addison.
Yeah, that's true.
And you know what? It works. I mean, I usually stay away from doing quote-unquote spiritual books or this type of, I don't know, what is this type of thing, but on this show. But there was something that was so real about it that one comes to identify with you, the writer, as much as observe this other person and place and culture.
Yeah, well, that's great to hear. I'm so glad. Yeah, that part kind of snuck up on me, too. I couldn't foresee that. I was just there going, here I am with my notebook. I'm going to ask a lot of questions. He's going to give me a lot of answers, and then I'm going to write this book about him because his life story is fascinating and really inspiring. And then, of course, publishing being what it is, I mean, my agent couldn't sell an early proposal of just a straight biography. And by that time, I'd been up there. I actually moved to Wyoming for 4 or 5 months in the winter of 2004. And I got really involved in the family and really involved in the extended family, and I was there all the time and started making my own mistakes. And I was realizing Stan was changing me. I mean, he's got a, there's some, for me, there was something like a healing field around him. I mean, I know the sweat lodge is very powerful, but just watching him move through his life was a really soothing, healing thing for me to watch somebody who, you know, physically is so disabled but is actually the most able person I've ever met, and who truly doesn't complain, doesn't just pretend to be okay and play the martyr and pretend he's fine and be passive-aggressive and infuriating that way. He really, truly is okay and really can do so much and really helps so many people and is so generous. And just being around that was like, oh, my God, I could just feel, you know, layers of ooky, you know, crazy, delusional, neurotic, ambitious, you know, white, college-educated, trained, you know, kind of conditioning start to kind of loosen up. And I started kind of waking up a little bit. So that was happening, and I was making scads of mistakes. And it was kind of interesting, and I started kind of getting in front of the camera. So, and that was actually, even though there's parts of that are, you know, it's you know, my finest moments. I mean, there are definitely some of my weaknesses are definitely included in the book. And I would rather expose those than try to become some expert on Native life, because I don't think you ever can, as a white person, become an expert on Native life or an expert even on a tribe. I didn't want to be in that role. So I started to really enjoy telling the story of Stanford's effect on people through the effect he was having on me.
We're talking to Lisa Jones, author of the book Broken, A Love Story. One of the things that you learned was that going in there with a list of 59 questions wasn't going to work, and that just watching and listening was really the key to understanding.
Exactly. Yeah. Shutting up. Sitting down, shutting up, watching, not needing to jump to conclusions.
How did this affect, I mean, this is a project that was underway for, what, 4 years that you were up there in Wyoming, really
engaging? Well,
it
depends where you start counting, because I first went up there in 2002, and then I spent a lot of time there early in 2004. So you could say it's been 5 years.
And how did that affect your work as a journalist? It seems like it really shook everything up to the root, including the way you wrote and thought about writing.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It was great to unlearn journalism, you know, because I think journalism is so, it's so much like the white mind, you know. It's like, tell me what's going on really fast, you know. And so you write short, and by excluding so much feeling and nuance, it's really not even accurate, even in its form. So I feel it was really hard to unlearn things like, you know, the nut graph. You go two paragraphs down in any magazine story, or two or three, and here's the paragraph that tells you everything that's happening. And I think that's born of a cultural expectation that you actually can figure out what's happening, and you should know what's happening, and that knowing what's happening makes things better, because it doesn't. And I just feel like life with Stan, there aren't so many conclusions, and there isn't so much kind of, I have a right to know the answer. It's like, who knows what the answer is? And so, you know, when you're trying to tease my writing apart so that it was more, had more space in it, and was, you know, took more time to describe things, and actually just spoke a lot in a subjective voice, because all you can say sometimes when you're confused is what you see, you know, rather than what's happening.
Right.
You know, what's happening from some, you know, godlike objective overview. I mean, it changed my writing a lot, and it's a lot more fun to write this new way.
Do you still get as much work writing this new way?
You know, work is not a big burgeoning part of life right now. I mean, work for pay isn't, because I'm actually working on publicizing the book until October, I've decided, and then we'll see what's happening. Because while I was writing the book, journalism as a profession has changed so dramatically, I don't even know really what it is anymore.
There's a place in the book where you talk about, apropos of what you're saying right now, developing, I think the way you put it was developing a place in your mind where things were neither confirmed nor denied, but mysterious. And living in that place is something that middle-class people aren't really, especially college-educated people, people who've had to write papers and answer questions, aren't trained to do, and especially journalists.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. So I walk around being really, really inconclusive these days, you know, whereas before I was super conclusive. So yeah, it's a whole different kettle of fish.
Meanwhile, you're writing this book about him. How did Stanford Addison, this medicine man, as he doesn't call himself, this horse breaker, which he also doesn't call himself, but he's more of a horse gentler, how did he feel about your being around all the time and having a notebook and recording all the things that he said?
I don't know. You'll have to ask him. I think we had a lot of fun, so that made it easier. And I think Stanford is so, you know, you think about a Native American traditional healer, and once again, courtesy of Hollywood, it's this big, pious, you know, kind of gruff, impenetrable, unapproachable kind of person. And Stanford is just the opposite. He's so easy to be with, and he makes you feel really welcome. And I felt very welcomed by him. He has a really good sense of humor. And so that, we just spent a lot of time laughing. I mean, even though the book has got a lot of very serious things in it and a lot of tragic things in it and a lot of painful things in it, there was just a lot of laughter there. And Stan, so I think that, I think he must have enjoyed it. And we did have a lot of fun, and I cooked a lot. So that was good. And, yeah, it's, yeah, that's the best I can answer that one, I think.
There's a number of other stories in it, and I don't know how much you want to get into them. The story of Moses, who was a white cowboy who'd had half of his face and a good part of his body burned very badly in a truck accident. And he was there, and at first you really didn't like him, but then you realized that he had, because he lived with the Northern Arapaho for so long, he had about as deep an understanding of that culture as any white person could.
Yeah, he was quite a character. And actually, going back to your last question about how did Stanford like having me around, Moses is the one who would call me on stuff, you know, in front of other people and embarrass me. He would say things like, I would go in there and start asking questions. And there's never, you're never really alone with anyone in a room at Stan's house. There's a lot of people there, and especially in the living room, the kitchen, there's always a lot of people. And I was asking some other guy, a friend of Stanford, some questions, and Moses goes, "Man, you're an interrogator," and everyone cracked up. You know, there were probably like 6 Native Americans in the room, and me and Moses, and so they're all laughing, and I could tell they totally agreed with him. But they were way too polite to say that, that Moses didn't have that problem. So he said it. And then Moses said, you know, you should really just visit and listen. You should quit asking so many questions. And I thought, oh, man, I can't stand people like you. But then I realized later he was totally right. So Moses is he's a very interesting character. And he and Stanford have kind of a sibling relationship. They're really close, and then they argue, and then Moses leaves. but Moses did really, he, unlike an anthropologist or a writer like me, he, well, me initially anyway, he went there because it was, he stayed there, I believe, because the Arapahos are a much softer, more accepting culture than white culture. And it was really, I think it's very hard for Moses to live in the white world because of his disfigurement and the judgment and harshness that is just completely embedded in our culture and that isn't in the Arapaho culture, although they teased him a lot and really, you know, really brazenly teased him sometimes about his burn.
I
or at
thought
least
it was,
Stanford's sister would. So.
Yeah, it's such an interesting contrast between the two cultures as you describe it, because on the one hand, he really couldn't live, I mean, with his face half melted off in white culture, which was so judgmental, and these Indians accepted him, but they also teased him as, you know, as white people really never would. You know, go light the fire. Your face is already burned off. So.
Right. I know. Isn't that interesting? Because actually telling that joke, you know, is a lot softer than kind of just averting your face. And I can imagine that, you know, that it's just say it.
Right.
And get it over with and laugh about it, because here we all are kind of suffering along through this lifetime, rather than white culture, where it's like, no, everything's perfectible, and you need to fix that, and this needs to stop, you know, that whole stuff.
It was also interesting to see the, at least intellectually, the parallels to Buddhism, because, of course, Buddhist practice is based on the idea that life is suffering, and so is this Northern Arapaho spirituality.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't say they would exactly say life is suffering, but suffering is so obvious and acknowledged, you know. And they laugh so much. I mean, I think the Arapahos have an amazing, I couldn't believe how funny everybody was and how much we laughed. And Stan once said to me, he said, if we didn't laugh, we'd cry. So that's why we laugh. I thought, wow, I agree, you know, like, that's a great way to live. So, there were a lot of, there's a lot of parallels between that and Buddhism. But, you know, Buddhism in America is a, you know, a fairly elite act, you know, it's a comfortable, I mean, just physically comfortable spiritual practice. And I used to laugh about the difference between going on a Buddhist retreat where you're really comfortable and you're in a nicely ventilated meditation hall and then somebody makes you some great lunch, you know, compared to the sweat lodge. And
I guess, although, I mean, I've sat a whole bunch of those 10-day meditation courses and I don't think I've ever endured so much back pain, mental pain, chest pain,
right.
Leg pain.
You're right. I think I'm forgetting. I haven't done one for a long time.
In any case, we're talking to Lisa Jones, the author of the book Broken, A Love Story. There are other funny little things that, I mean, I'm always fascinated by cultural differences just because things that seem superficial really run deep. And another difference is that we have in whatever white American culture or just mainstream American culture a real kind of Boy Scout safety culture with railings and safety belts and all sorts of constraints and guards against accidents and untimely death and so on. And they don't have any of that there, neither in their mentality nor in their practices. And some of it is born of poverty, although not completely. And the result is that a lot of people get hurt and die.
Yeah. I would say a lot of people get hurt and die more. I think it's especially hard for the boys who, you know, are like 17 to 24. You know, there's that, all that testosterone and then all that open road and cars and not much money and not much job. And, you know, I mean, God, you just wonder. It is. There's a lot more violence and there's a lot more poverty and there's a lot less economic development or whatever you want to call it. There's a lot. I mean, I think some people, you know, some of the women I know, they're definitely strapped their kids into, you know, to their seatbelts when they drive. I don't think everyone runs around being reckless, but I just think there's this, life's hard there. Life's hard. It's poor and it's economically poor and the distances are huge on the roads and there's tons of drunk drivers. It's hard.
And meanwhile, you at first were a little bit wary, but then became friends with this and very close to and had very tender feelings toward this group of teenage Indian rapper boys.
Yeah, they were awesome. Yeah, they are the greatest. I mean, they're these soft sweethearts. And on the outside, at first, you know, here I was visiting white woman, and at first they just look like straight off of an MTV, you know, rap kind of video, and I was like, you know, and they're great. They're great, and their rap lyrics are really kind of amazing. And Stan works with, he has pretty much a rotating cast of teenage boys and some girls but mostly boys who rotate through his house, and a lot of them are relatives of some degree, and then some of them are actually furloughed to him by the tribe, and they live at his house and they work with the horses and they hang out and they laugh and they make meals and they, you know, do the sweat lodge, and he does pretty darn well with a lot of those boys. He teaches them a lot of you know, kind of just good sense and connection with the horses. And he's quite, he performs quite a role just with those teenage boys. And I think part of that is because when he knows what it's like to be a teenage Arapaho boy and run wild and be reckless and drink tons and, you know, do drugs. And he did all of it. He did all of it and more. And then he had this accident. And so he's not only, but he doesn't, you know, he's not like a person who works with kids who doesn't really know what they're talking about. He knows everything they're talking about. He knows, and he knows about the poverty and the anger. And the, and so he's a really empathetic, but, you know, quite strict guy with those kids.
The title of the book is Broken, A Love Story, and it's such a great title because broken refers to so many different things. The horses are broken, but they're not really broken. Stanford Addison is broken by his accident. He's a quadriplegic, but he also is whole in this way that the rest of us can only dream of. You, the author, the observer, the participator, are finding the broken places within yourself. And one of the things that I was thinking about while reading it was, and this comes out in some specific experiences in the book, which we won't give away, is that no matter what anybody tells you, whether it's telling you through, I'm sitting here reading a book and learning that way, or Stanford Addison telling you this is how things are and this is what you should do, blah, 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 you really have to learn things through experience, and especially these great big life lessons. And so writing a book like this, I felt like it's really a humbling experience, because no matter how well you write it, and this book is beautifully written, it's very, very wonderful to read, and just the language is so well written. Your readers, you can only take them to a certain place, and the rest of it they have to do themselves in whatever their life path is.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it's true. And Stanford was great that way. Like, he's so, like, there's so many times I'm like, well, what do I do now? Or, you know, help. And he'd be like, you just got to learn for yourself. He's like, I could tell you, but it wouldn't stick. You got to have your own experience. And that, you're right, that's true for readers too. Because I've had some people say to me, well, what really happens? You know, tell me the, you know, all the magic things that you were near. And I'm like, well, it's not really, first of all, I don't, it's almost like, do it yourself, you know, like, go have an experience like that. Go find someone that can show you these things, you know?
Yeah.
And not, I mean, not in a hostile way, but it's just like, life is full of these kinds of possibilities, I think. And they're not in the mainstream of our culture. There are other places.
And they're really there for you all the time at the same time. Although,
yeah.
Maybe more so in the West, I don't know. I was thinking about having lived here in New Mexico for 20 years, there's a great familiarity about a lot of things in this book that I wondered if my fellow readers, colleagues, age mates, whatever, in Rhode Island and New York and so on would relate to.
Right.
I don't know.
Well, it does seem like the landscape in the West, you know, really does let your imagination free a little bit more than it does in Rhode Island.
Yeah, maybe there are people in Rhode Island having experiences with whatever, New England leprechauns or something.
Yeah. You never know. You never know.
We're talking to Lisa Jones. The book is called Broken, A Love Story. Lisa, this is such a little thing, but it stood out to me, and that is that the food that you eat when you're in Wyoming and that when you're hanging around with Stanford and the folks there is what we might call really bad food, really bad for you food. And it's the kind of thing where if you were living on that diet while living in Boulder, you'd get sick to your stomach, and for some reason there, you were thriving on it. I found that fascinating.
Well, you know what was the funniest is, well, I will say that at one point I traveled with Stan to Iowa to visit another tribe that was having some problems that he was helping them with, and Basically, there's just so much meat in Stan's diet and in all the guys I met up there in their diet and gals. And I'm not a vegetarian, but I don't eat tons of meat. And Stan was so sweet. One time he had the boys go out and get me a bag of fruit because I was like, ugh. And, yeah, the eating is really different. But I didn't – yeah, it's funny. I really pretty much thrived. What I really thrived on was all the Folgers coffee. That made me really happy. I loved that.
You were drinking Folgers coffee cup after cup with non-dairy creamer at midnight and sleeping like a baby.
Yeah, go figure. I can't do that at home, believe me. Like, and I don't know what it was, if it was just like – everyone else was doing it and sleeping like a baby, or it was just the, you know, the calming effect of being at Stan's house, or what it was. But it is pretty funny because now I can't drink caffeine since, you know, past lunch anymore. But up there I can. But it's pretty weak coffee too, you know.
But still, it's that kind of thing that makes you realize how much the mind is involved in all these reactions that our body has to things.
Yeah, exactly. You're right.
The story ends in a way, and again, we don't want to give too much of the book away because it's really highly worth reading. I mean, I think anybody, whatever stage they're at in life, whatever place they're in, would find something fascinating in this book. But there's this way in which you were transitioning from putting Stanford Addison, this shaman type of person, horse trainer, and so on, transitioning from putting him on a pedestal to really just having him be your friend, and he makes it clear that he's not some kind of demigod, he's just a man. But I have to say, reading the whole book and seeing the portrait of him that you paint, you don't see too much that's not nice about the guy.
Yeah, he is a pretty nice guy. I mean, he's not perfect. He can be really grumpy, and he can, you know, he has off days like everyone else, and there was that one time with that one horse that was pretty, pretty hard. But he is a really special person. I mean, there's just no way around it. But he's not, you know. I think I came into it with a bunch of my own needs and baggage that, of course, I had no clue of the contents of the details of what it was. But I think I put him on this huge pedestal, and then. I didn't need him to be on the pedestal anymore, and it was a huge relief when he fell off, and he was relieved too. You know, I mean, now it's a much different relationship. I still don't think it's a relationship of equals. I really do think he's special. You know, I think he's remarkable and special, and has has kind of overcome things more than anyone I've ever met, and most people I've ever read about. So. But now it's a little more, there's a little less kind of rapt, childlike adoration coming out of me, which is probably such a relief to him.
And probably to you, too.
Yeah.
So you will be reading tomorrow afternoon, Saturday, August 22nd, from 4 to 7 at the Teresa Neptune Gallery, which is at 616 and a half A Canyon Road. It's a little alley kind of on the right as you're going up Canyon Road. It's a wonderful place. It's a great gallery. Teresa Neptune's a terrific photographer. What are you going to be doing at this event?
Well, this event is going to be so great. It's a three-woman show, pretty much. It's me and Teresa Neptune, who takes unbelievably beautiful photographs. And I met her actually up at Stan's, and her exhibit that's hung now is all about that. It's all about the Wind River and Stanford. And her work is for sale. And Angelique Midthunder will also be there. And she's another Santa Fe person who made a really terrific PBS documentary on Stanford called The Silent Thunder that won the Gaia Award in 2006. And she's got copies of that DVD for sale, too. And she'll be screening the movie. So you can go there. You can look at the photos. You can watch Angelique's movie. And then I'm going to be reading at three different times, at 4:30, 5:30, and 6:30. And Stanford will be there. So that's really exciting. And he's making the trip down from Wyoming with some of his, with his son Daniel and a couple of other guys. So if you come, you can meet him.
Lisa Jones is the author of the book Broken, A Love Story, published by Scribner, and once again the event from 4 to 7 at the Teresa Neptune Gallery in Santa Fe at 616 and a half A Canyon Road. Lisa, thank you so much for being with us on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. It's been fun.
The event with Lisa Jones is sponsored by Garcia Street Books. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR is streaming live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, Jazz a la Carta. Thanks to Brian Highhill, by the way, for engineering today. Robert Knott will be back with us next week.